Welcome back. It's a Tuesday, the 23rd day of April, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And the news today is honestly a mix of the unbelievable and the downright obscene. For example, the war on scripture, along with the war on truth, continues and escalates, as some of the Waystream banner headlines make clear. For example, the WAPO is now trying to shift the narrative. They say, quote, "Sri Lanka blasts were retaliation for New Zealand shooting," says official. Well, there you go. I guess those nasty Christians got what was coming to them, says the semi-official Waystream narrative. The UK's Daily Mail is pushing the same spiel, having evidently gotten the memo, while the New York Times says ISIS now claims responsibility for the bombings. But yes, they were payback for what happened in New Zealand. Just as disconcerting, they tell us that the feral bunglers of investigations from the U.S. have joined the so-called investigation. That'll fix it. But who knows? Maybe they'll find another reason to reopen the Mueller witch hunt against the President of the United States and blame him somehow. Deep down within the articles, they do admit that there were now not one, but two Islamist extremist groups that were probably involved, not just one, and seven different suicide bombers, and the official number of people dead has been raised to 321. But as far as I know, we haven't seen any reports of elected officials in New Zealand wearing crosses in sympathy with these folks. And I'll make one more politically incorrect suggestion, given just how badly everything about the New Zealand Christchurch false flag seems to increasingly stink to high heaven. Is it really any kind of a surprise to anyone how the jihadis are now pointing to that event as an excuse for an escalation of violence that we all knew was coming anyway? After all, they did get the expected, massively politically correct response from the idiots in New Zealand. They got the gun control, they got the worldwide sympathy, and now they've managed to kill a whole bunch, many times more people, and it's only just beginning. Almost makes you wonder, says this particular cynic, if some of this wasn't exactly the plan all along. We'll follow that up with more from another front in what probably amounts to the same war, the southern U.S. border with Mexico. Remember, yesterday, Mexico warned about their deep concern that there were actually armed citizens in New Mexico trying to capture border invaders. How dare they? But at least Mexico could count on the FBI coming to their aid and arresting the leader of that group, if not the leaders of the hordes of invaders. But this next item is a story that's not getting nearly the attention that it deserves. This comes from Doug Hagman at thehagmanreport.com, as well as David Horowitz at the Conservative Review. And honestly, I'll tell you up front, it buries the lead. Here we go. On April 13th of 2019, didn't hear about this for over a week and a half, at approximately 2 p.m. Central Daylight Time, 5 to 6 Mexican military personnel questioned two U.S. Army soldiers, they were outnumbered, who were conducting border support operations in an unmarked Customs and Border Protection vehicle near the southwest border of the United States in the vicinity of Clint, Texas. Allow that to sink in and consider carefully what you just heard, said Hagman. The Mexican military crossed the border, entered the United States, and confronted the United States military. But wait, folks, there's more. Here's how Daniel Horowitz put it. The armed men swiftly approached U.S. service members crossing over from the Mexican side of the Rio Grande into U.S. territory and ordering the soldiers out of their vehicle, drumroll please, at gunpoint. Now let me get this straight. The communist criminal cartel-run Mexican government is oh so concerned about the fact that free people in the United States might be allowed to keep and bear arms. They don't allow that among their peons. But they're more than willing to send armed troops across the border and commit an act of war against U.S. military personnel. If this was another beta test, folks, to see how far the United States government can be pushed, the Trump regime just failed spectacularly. Either that or caved utterly to the deep state swamp. And their complicit deep state media doesn't even bother to report it. Daniel Horowitz, however, nails it. Quote, "Why is it that our government," I have to put sick after that for sure, because I don't think it's our government anymore. Anyway, why is it, he said, that our government, which appears unable or unwilling to deal with Mexican aggression, the cartels, or illegal immigration, is suddenly pursuing a zero-tolerance policy for American militias, seeking to do the job the federal government won't do. failing to secure our borders is a breach of the social contract of government as laid out in the Declaration of Independence. Actually, folks, it's laid out right there in the Constitution, too, and it's not just a breach of the social contract. It's a breach of the rule of law and the very purpose for which that government was supposed to exist in the first place. Continues Horowitz, if there was anything that would ever justify the citizenry to take action, it's this issue. Well, there's more coming. We'll get to that in a second. It's not something he said we want to see, but where is our own government in dealing with the problem? From there, we go to this story, and how many of these are we going to have to see before people wake up and realize that the WAPO, CNN, MSNBC, and most of the waste stream, including most of the criminal traitors in Congress, have been lying through their teeth for a long time now? Officials in Las Cruces, New Mexico, says a piece from Bob Price at Breitbart, reported on Monday that Border Patrol agents released nearly 1,600 migrants into their community over just a 10-day period. And the city, which doesn't have the money, was forced to spend about $75,000 for so-called humanitarian assistance. And in case you're curious, the population of Las Cruces is right about 100,000, meaning they got more than 1.5% of their entire population dumped on them right across the border in about a third of a month. Border Patrol officials said the story began releasing migrants apprehended in the El Paso sector on April the 12th, according to the El Paso ABC affiliate. And these releases come as the sector reached a breaking point, with thousands of Central American migrant families crossing the border illegally in West Texas and the New Mexico boot heel. Just recently, the city of Las Cruces responded by setting up a network of temporary shelters to house the so-called asylum seekers while they attempt to arrange travel to scatter them all over the rest of the United States. And nearly 1,200 were dropped off by Border Patrol agents during the first week of the invasion alone. Mayor Ken Miyagashami told the local newspaper that most of the migrants, quote, move out quickly. 75% are gone, he said. And get this, folks. The mayor has made arrangements with the cities of Santa Fe and Albuquerque further north to take the migrants on a rotating basis. Looks like they'll be taking some, he said. We just need to figure out transportation. Yeah, we could easily handle a couple hundred, but not 200 a day, the mayor explained. That's why I'm thinking if Santa Fe can do a couple of hundred every 3 days, I think that's more manageable. And does anybody else see just a little bit of a problem here? Why am I suddenly hearkening back to old movies with titles like Escape from Los Angeles and Escape from New York? The trouble is, those liberal sanctuary city hellholes don't yet have walls around them to keep the invaders in. And about the only thing we know for sure about them, other than that many are carrying disease, is that they've demonstrated they do not respect borders, laws, and property rights. Officials from the New Mexico Department of Homeland Security, SICK, told the El Paso TV station they expect more asylum seekers to continue to be dropped off in Las Cruces, well, for at least several more weeks. And in the meantime, county officials in neighboring Otero County declared a state of emergency, unanimously, and called on the traitorous New Mexico governor to redeploy the National Guard that she ordered out of the area so that Border Patrol agents can reopen interior checkpoints, according to the El Paso Times. Quote, if this demand is not met by the state of New Mexico in 1 week's time, the county of Otero will take action itself to provide security and safety and well-being for the people in this county, said the county commission chairman Coy Griffin in a statement. Otero County will also consider litigation in regards to the state of New Mexico failing to follow its constitutional duties towards the people of Otero County. New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham isn't the only outright traitor sitting in a governor's mansion, though. In New Jersey, the traitorous slimebag Governor Phil Murphy wants to significantly increase the cost of owning a gun in the state, proposing fees that even the New York Times admits would be among the highest in the country to do what was once called a God-given right protected by a constitution these people now not only detest, but actively seek to undermine. Traitors from without and traitors from within. Guess which is more dangerous? The new fee, says a summary piece from Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge, would, as they always do, disproportionately punish low-income, law-abiding, mostly minority gun owners, but the left doesn't care about that, who wish to defend themselves and their families in increasingly, and no surprise here, high-crime areas. And by the time these traitors have completely disarmed them, they'll be far higher crime areas still. The idiot oathbreaker claims there is, quote, no war on responsible gun owners, unquote. No, it's a war on all gun owners, folks. But that the funds raised from the fee hike would simply go towards anti-violence initiatives, basically echoing Einstein's famous definition of insanity. And as if to emphasize that, the traitorous governor said this, quote, I was in Jersey City. It's at least $10 to get a dog license in Jersey City, but it's still $2 to get a permit to purchase a firearm in New Jersey, unquote. Well, gee, you blankety-blankin' liar, which one is protected by the Constitution as a God-given right? And furthermore, since when do peons who aren't actually slaves have to get a permit from you to have a dog or a gun? And that, folks, is the element of this article that I really wanted to emphasize for a minute. The very concept, back when we had a rule of law of shall not be infringed, meant there's no way that you have to have a permit to exercise a God-given right to begin with. But once you've allowed that fundamental principle to be violated, what follows is obvious. Currently, says the story, a firearm ID costs $5. A permit for a slave to own a gun is $2, and a permit to carry a gun costs just, what do you mean, just, $20. The slave master wants to raise that to $100 for the ID, Achtung, $50 just to be allowed as a slave to have a gun. You don't really own it if you have to have a permit, of course, and $400 if you thought you might be able to first keep and then carry it. In addition, Murphy wants to slap another 10% excise tax on ammunition and a 2.5% firearms excise tax. So in other words, he wants to raise the slave fees to do that which free people once did anyway by a factor of 20. And how many more times will they have to do that before first the low income and then the middle class are priced out of the ability to defend themselves from what they intend to do completely? Let me say it again. Slaves don't have rights. And once you allow that Big Brother has a claim to require a permit before you can do something that once free people did without it, it's just a matter of time until they decide, we'll raise the fee so high that the slaves get the idea, figure out who's boss, and give up trying. From there we go next to this. More lies from the highest levels and more whistleblowing from those who really know. This comes from Mark F. McCarty via Medium.com, and it has to do with the mysterious death of one Seth Rich, the imprisonment of Julian Assange, and the lies that have linked all of that with the overhyped scapegoat of Russian hacking, and of course, the infamous Mueller witch hunt report. It starts by noting that an attorney named Ty Clevenger issued a FOIA request a long time ago regarding the late Seth Rich. He received a response saying the request had been processed under the FOIA provisions, and 15 documents of 32 pages responsive to this request have been reviewed by the agency as required by FOIA, but they're classified top secret and secret, so you can't have them. Prompting McCarty to write that although I was somewhat confused by the initial meaning of this revelation, it does bear comment because at the very least it meant that the view that Seth Rich was the source of the WikiLeaks DNC releases was more than the brainless and callous conspiracy theory that the waste stream media were trying to make it out to be. In other words, you have to ask the obvious question. Just why does the NSA have 32 pages of secret and top secret documents on the late Seth Rich? But fortunately, one of the highest executives ever to turn a whistleblower, and one of the smartest men, as he puts it, ever to work for the U.S. government, William Benny, has offered clarification on all of this in a brief interview with Ed Butowski that he gave just last week, in which he offers a devastating rebuke of the fraudulent Mueller report's analysis of so-called Russian hacking. But the truly fascinating part occurs well into the interview, where Benny discusses Clevenger's FOIA request and says, quote, Ty Clevenger has FOIA'd information from NSA asking for any data that involved both Seth Rich and also Julian Assange. And they responded by saying, we've got 15 files, 32 pages, but they're all classified in accordance with Executive Order 13526, covering classification, and therefore you can't have them. That means the NSA has records of communications between Seth Rich and Julian Assange. And continues Benny, I mean, that's the only business NSA is in, copying communications between people and devices. And if you're curious, folks, Executive Order 13526 is, of course, from the Obama regime, dated December 29th, 2009. One of a series of such outlining how that guy wanted classified information to be handled. No surprise. So basically, what the man once called the father of the NSA is saying provides strong support for the hypothesis that Seth Rich was indeed the source for WikiLeaks of the DNC emails it published. Assange, it says, is strongly hinted at this. Cy Hirsch claims to have a trusted informant inside the FBI who states he has seen FBI documents verifying it. And Binney himself says he has not one but two sources inside the intelligence community vouching for this. And Bill Binney has long offered technical evidence suggesting that the Russian fingerprints and the metadata and the whole Russia hacked the DNC from afar story is utter BS. Timestamps on the data prove that it couldn't have been remotely hacked via a slower overseas internet connection, had to have been taken off of a much higher speed thumb drive inserted directly into the servers in question, like at DNC headquarters, by somebody with access there. As Binney himself makes clear, the Mueller report's tale of how WikiLeaks allegedly received the DNC emails from GRU agents styling themselves as Guccifer 2.0 is absurd on its face to reasonable people who will examine the pertinent evidence. Far from being a Russian hacker masquerading as a Romanian, the story continues, G2.0 has operated in U.S. time zones, downloaded some of his hacks via thumb drive, purposely implanted Russian fingerprints in a kind of an amateur way besides in the metadata of his own releases, impersonating a Russian using intermittently broken English, and furthermore, never himself published any documents denigratory to the Clinton campaign. The GRU, if they really did hack the DNC, would have had no need for such a ridiculous figure. But G2.0 functions wonderfully as a vehicle for incriminating Russia as the source of the emails published by WikiLeaks, tarring Assange and Russia with the same brush. Almost, folks, like it was a softball being pitched directly to Bob Mueller's team. And furthermore, says the story, if you examine Mueller's report carefully, you'll note that he never actually states, much less demonstrates, that the material which Guccifer 2.0 passed along to WikiLeaks consisted of the DNC emails which WikiLeaks published, undoubtedly because Mueller has no evidence for this. And indeed, there are a number of technical details which don't match up either. The cyber analytic findings pointing to Guccifer 2.0 being a fraud masquerading as a Russian hacker are, in fact, touched on in Binney's interview and comprehensively discussed in the website of Adam Carter devoted to the issue. But here's the big question. How does Mueller's so-called report deal with all of this countervailing evidence? Does he offer credible rebuttals to each of the findings? No. With consummate dishonesty, he simply ignores all of the evidence in toto. And he feels no compunction to address that evidence because, with rare exceptions, the waystream media has done such a good job covering things up that most Americans are wholly unaware of the whole issue. Mueller's report on so-called Russian meddling, says McCarty, is simply intended to reinforce the deep state's preferred narrative, which he achieves by cherry-picking the evidence that he deigns to consider. And that was the precise strategy that the deep state, including Mueller himself, employed when they sold the nation out previously on Saddam's alleged WMDs. And here's another intriguing point. CrowdStrike's co-founder, Sean Henry, used to be Mueller's deputy at the FBI, acting head of the counterintelligence division. And Adam Carter, says the author, informs me that while Henry headed that division, it made an attempt to destroy WikiLeaks' reputation by feeding it bogus documents that had been purposely altered. Fortunately, WikiLeaks exercised its customary caution and refused to take the bait. So Guccifer 2.0, very likely also a creation of CrowdStrike, appears to have been yet another attempt to smear WikiLeaks. But this one's worked wonderfully well with much of the gullible American public. Hillary Clinton's incompetence was expiated, WikiLeaks was smeared, and Russia was further defamed, all in one stroke. As he puts it, it's a deep state wet dream. Assange became not a journalist, working with an American whistleblower disgusted by the gross bias of the DNC against Bernie, but instead a tool of malign Russians intent on meddling in our so-called democracy and saddling us with the ridiculous Trump. And as to Seth Rich's mysterious death, Well, ask yourself this. Who would have been in a perfect position to destroy the Russia, Russia, Russia hacking narrative that Clinton's campaign and CrowdStrike had decided to run with? Answer, dead men tell no tales. Next, I have just a couple of quick comments on the impact of all of that, courtesy of James Howard Kunstler via Kunstler.com and all kinds of other places. The Russiagate fiasco, he says, is only half over. And that's unfortunate for the nation. There's just too much documented official turpitude, he continues, on the public record for the authorities to answer for, and the institutional damage runs too deep. Act 1, the Mueller witch hunt, was a 22-month circle jerk of prosecutorial misconduct and media malfeasance. But Act 2, he says, will be the circular firing squad of former officials assassinating each other's character. Well, if they had any to assassinate, I guess, to desperately avoid prosecution. And would that it be so? In the meanwhile, this is where I part company with him a bit, but he does make the smokescreen point. There is the nation's business, which has been hopelessly burdened by an hallucinatory overlay of wokester idiocy emanating from the college campi eye, so that even in the absence of the Mueller distraction, every organized endeavor in this land, from sea to shining sea, will be paralyzed by race and gender hustles. Next up, he suggests a national debate over reparations for slavery in the never-ending quest to monetize moral posturing. Now here I scratch my head and say, what? Are you really kidding me? Is this the kind of idiocy that the waste stream thinks it can get America to focus on while it's being destroyed from without and from within? Well, if history is any guide, folks, don't doubt it for a minute. As one of my favorite authors, Robert Heinlein, once said, never underestimate the power of human stupidity, particularly when there are lives at stake. Kunstler goes through the litany of other major economic problems and bogus solutions, like the ticking time bombs of health care, college loan debt, pension funds, the stock market bubble, and of course, Medicare for All and the Green New Deal. Smoke and mirrors for now? Yeah, eventually, inevitably, it will blow up. But as is the case with all foundering empires, he concludes, the end will be a sickening slide into a new and strange disposition of things. So perhaps, he writes, one of the last successful acts of the American Empire might be to send the Russia, Russia, Russiagate instigators to jail. And I guess that makes him more optimistic than your host. Finally today, I want to take a look at something that Dave Hodges of the Common Sense Show did concerning what he calls the cartel takeover of local American communities. And it reflects the changing political and law enforcement sick landscape of the new America. The problem, he says, is that the drug cartels coming north out of Mexico are following an established Agenda 21, or UN model, based on local control of the political process, resulting in dramatic bottom-up control. Agenda 21 has now become Agenda 2030, and it focuses on replacing local law enforcement agencies in favor of new, friendly, and on-the-payroll personnel. And also, he says, we're seeing more and more obscure individuals brought in from other communities in order to assume positions of leadership in the local political and law enforcement community. He refers first to his story about the takeover of Humboldt County, California, by the cartels, and says since then, many first-hand accounts have come my way, and we've discovered similar things happening in communities across America, from Ohio to Florida to New Mexico to California. And there's compelling and increasing evidence of cartel control of many local communities. And here's just one example from a writer in New Mexico that he says represents more than a dozen like it he's seen. Every little village in the area, he says, has a cartel rep in residence. And the locals tell me they all know who the person is. That individual keeps an eye on what's going on in the village and the attitude towards the cartel and notes any talkers. No one dares to say a word against the cartel, and anyone who gets crosswise with them tends to disappear. See, you thought it was just in Mexico, but that was back when we had a border. Since the cartel moved into the county, the email continues, most of the longtime deputies at the sheriff's office have left and been replaced by new guys. Some of them are married to women from the cartel families, and it's pretty much assumed the sheriff's office is compromised, and the residents basically know better than to bother to report problems. He does point out that at least in New Mexico, lots of people are routinely armed for self-defense. They do have open carry, so it's not uncommon in most rural areas to see people with sidearms, and you can bet most pickups have a gun within reach. And there's a message in all of this, too, even though, yeah, the waste stream isn't about to tell you. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.